The views expressed in this podcast are solely those of the speaker. This podcast is for informational purposes only and is not a substitute for professional medical advice from your own physician.
Well, hi, everybody, and thanks very much for joining our fifth podcast for the Mass Biologics space. I'm very pleased to be again joined by my co-host, Dr. Zori Boucher from the Gerling Institute and NYU. And maybe, Zori, could you maybe do a brief little intro of yourself?
Absolutely. Hi, everyone. As Mark said, we are really glad that we are coming to our fifth episode of podcast, and hopefully this will conclude and help you understand where we stand with regenerative therapies for intervertebral disc. My name is Zori Boucher. As Mark said, I'm a director of research in regenerative medicine here at Gerling Institute and also an assistant professor in the Department of Orthopedic Surgery at NYU.
Great. And I'm Mark Irwin. I'm an assistant professor in divisions of neurological orthopedic surgery at the University of Toronto. And as full disclosure, I'm the chief science officer of a novel biotech company. And we're looking to commercialize a new regenerative therapeutic to treat disc disease. And we may talk about that a bit later on. But the main focus for today's podcast is to really to try to zero in on biologic therapy for the disc and what have we accomplished and what's still missing. You know, why hasn't we made significant progress so far? And, you know, that we have, there's actually a bit misleading to say that because we have made progress. It's just that nothing's really translated to mainstream yet. There's all kinds of interventions actively being investigated, some in various phases of human trials, some still in preclinical work. But the question really is, you know, we're facing with this hostile environment in the disc, and a lot is still not known about what happens in the disc. As our previous podcast talked about, we have difficulties posed by the actual milieu of the disc, pro-catabolic, low pH, low perfusion, hypoxic environment. Then we have questions of what the end plates contribute to this whole degenerative cascade and process and how do they interact. We don't really know that well yet. There are more information is coming, but it's still a bit of a slow process. And I guess, you know, we need to consider how any therapy would affect the cell extracellular matrix integration and how does one affect the other and so far. And also our biologic therapy definitions maybe require a little bit of explanation. Like we have protein-based, we have cell-based, maybe we have body-derived substances like PRP, for example, and perhaps we have ECM kind of engineered matrices with some other method of introduction to disc space. So the question is, like, what are the targets? Is it target the disc nucleus itself? Is it target the annulus? Is it the end plate? Is it all three? How do you do that? And what if you try to do any of all of the above, how? Is it best to do a direct injection into the disc? And if you do, how do you avoid downstream disc degeneration? Should it be in whatever the intervention is, should it be in some kind of slow release formulation? Is it possible to have a systemic delivery? All these questions need to be addressed when discussing the potential for biologic therapy to be successful. So with that, maybe I'll ask Zori to comment about protein and non-cellular therapies. And what do you think is going on here, Zori?
Thanks, Mark. So you really well summarized, and what we have to always keep in mind when it comes to disc regenerative, irrespective if it's end plate, annulus, nucleus, we always have to start with the in vitro and animal models that don't necessarily translate when we get to clinical trials. And that's a huge obstacle. And I just want to mention that disc cells in animal models have a very different metabolism and they can produce much more matrix. So when we inject, and I will go, and that's really important with protein-based therapies, when they get that boost, we can see that restoration, I won't say regeneration, but potentially of disc height that then we fail to see in human and patients and clinical trials. So when we discuss this, to your point, we always have to adjust our expectations. Where we stand, so in the last couple of decades, obviously focus was scaffolds, and then move to the cells, and then in the last decade, also growth factors. In preclinical setting, there were various growth factors from BMPs that were successful in spinal fusion tested in the disc. It didn't necessarily always go well. Sometimes there was a bone formation, especially in the outer rib. And that actually happened with some of the cell studies as well, with stem cells, because they are undifferentiated. And they, if there is leakage towards the end plates, there were actually some studies that showed osteophytes. So we have to be careful on that end. But in the last, if we were to capture where we stand clinically, in the last at least 5 to 7 years, it was definitely PRP that has been extensively studied. And I believe if we zero it in further down on low back pain, there are over 5 clinical trials. Some of them are completed. So it will be interesting to see the results. The challenge with PRP is that it's really concentrated growth factors, if we were to simplify, but there are also some blood residues still in there. So while disc is avascular, as a healthy disc, and it's forgiving, so to speak, to what we inject, that changes during degeneration. So the question stays, and at least the preliminary PRP data for low back pain, it does show reduction in inflammation, but there is no radiological hard evidence that shows where we stand. Okay, is there an improvement in disc height? And we have to be realistic. Some of the stats show that for cells, and we will go into that later, would take a couple of decades to restore a third of the disc. So certainly I think with PRP, people are trying to zero down the protocol, how, what kind of PRP would be beneficial for disc if it does work, and really boils down to that protocol and how much to inject. So that's, I think, where we stand. And very often that knowledge gets transferred from other joints where in sports medicine, people have seen success. But that's a very different environment than disc itself. What I find very interesting, and it's coming, there have been studies that are hitting that preclinical clinical edge are different types of protein or protein-related therapies. And I would love for you to comment on that a bit further.
Sure. The area is fascinating, right? Because when you look at what is PRP? Well, we know they're activated platelets that release growth factors somehow, and then they're injected and you hope it works. It's largely uncharacterized. Nobody really knows what's in there. And there's considerable variability from person to person, a postmenopausal female versus a younger person versus an older guy. Everyone's PRP is different. And so it's very difficult to study something like this when you don't know what's actually in it. It's a kind of grab bag, right, of cytokines, and you hope for the best. In many ways, I would argue, and we'll talk about it in a bit, stem cells are kind of like that too. And that the typical, most, well, I'll leave it to later, but there's some limitations and drawbacks with respect to stem cells and knowing what they do and how they work. As far as growth factors are concerned, you know, as you mentioned, BMP has been tried, has shown some unwanted changes like bone formation and so forth. You know, our group, and I'll be, again, full disclosure, I'm the chief science officer of this new biotech company is trying to commercialize our extensively published work. We went way back to developmental biology and like, why is it that mongrel dogs don't get this disease? Beagles, dachshunds, shih tzus, terriers, these so-called chondrodystrophic dogs virtually always do. Well, one contains notochordal cells in the discs. That's the non-chondrodystrophic dog. The other ones don't. So we thought, well, maybe they make something. So 23 years later, we figured out the secretome, what these notochordal cells make. And it seems they found out two important growth factors, that's transforming growth factor beta 1 and connective tissue growth factor, or CCN2, seem to be important players. We've shown some pretty encouraging preclinical evidence. Now, fortunately, it's not just in rats, because as you know, rats and mice and all their own limitations, they're very small. Mice have transannular diffusion, which humans do not. So we did a study looking at three-year-old beagle dogs, and we showed some pretty impressive work. It's published a couple of years ago in Scientific Reports, where we show not restoration, but maintenance of disc height and things like you're addressing earlier. So we're hopeful that may pan out down the road, and trials are we're a ways away from that, but we're working on it. And the idea, I think the strength of this approach is it's kind of a developmental approach. We didn't just try some growth factor and see what happens. This is seems to be how the disc works. So we think that that's one avenue. And there are others, of course, out there too. Some people are looking at TGF-beta inhibitors. Some people suggest that too much TGF-beta is a bad idea. That might be true. We've done a lot of work looking at human disc cells in surgery. And I think I'm making the numbers wrong. I think it's around 30 cases. And we found one that we could find TGF-beta. The other ones, we couldn't even detect it. So we think it's a deficiency, but it may well be a necessary and sufficient kind of aspect here. So there's a lot to be said about potential growth factors. And again, how long do they hang around once they're injected? Mm-hmm. Nobody really knows yet. Should they be in a slow release formulation, or is too much over too long a bad idea? So a lot needs to be sorted out before we get to kind of the gold standard, as it were. But so let me ask you this then. We talked about biologic therapies in terms of growth factors, cytokines, PRP, and so forth. Let's get back to the kind of the elephant in the room here, kind of the cell-based therapy. You know, stem cells are very sexy to talk about, right? But what kind of cells should you put in there? How do you get in? Do you inject them, I guess? How many? What do they do? Do we have any idea what their function is? And what might limitations be for cell-based therapies? And if you do it once and it seems to help a patient, can you do it again? Or would the cell debris in there be a problem for the immune system? So, Lori, what are your thoughts on that?
Absolutely. So, as you said, yes, cell therapies have been around since, I believe, 94. So we are reaching a third decade that we really focused and studied from animal models, and then in the last decade, for sure, into clinical trials. When it comes to cells, obviously, and you mentioned, and we spoke about that through all of our podcasts, we have annulus and nucleus. And I want to say that the majority of preclinical and clinical work is really focusing on that nucleus, the center, to restore. Or I sometimes wonder, are we really regenerating or just slowing down, stopping that degeneration? And maybe if it's in an early stage, it gives a boost to the remaining disc cells to go back to their state and continue producing matrix and rebuilding it. But what we have to keep in mind, even before we dive deeper into what cells, is that disc cells, again, we have to repeat this, disc is a harsh environment. So nucleus pulposus cells are very resilient, and they are adapt in the sense that they can change if the pH, oxygen levels, and given that there are barely any nutrients, they can adapt to that. Whereas when we have an influx of cells that don't change that quickly and they were not primed to that environment, that's where a lot of bad can happen. And that's what studies have shown in preclinical setting. And some clinical trials, given that they are not seeing much of a difference, are alluding towards that cells just die or go apoptosis and senescence. When it comes to specific cell types, definitely if we would to look, and we've done within our AO Knowledge Forum, we are really focused on regenerative biologics and osteobiologics, but we've looked at where do we stand clinically now. A lot of cells are bone marrow stem cells. There are a few trials on adipose, and then a study or two on disc-like cells, actually, that disc using disc-like cells. They just, I believe, finished the two-year follow-up. So it will be interesting to see the actual data, the numbers, where they stand, and how they compare to stem cells. Most of the stem cells, given that they are bone marrow, they are autologous. There are only a few clinical trials. Actually, I should correct myself. There is only one clinical trial or case studies, and that's the challenge that we don't have a protocol in the sense, what are the right patients? How many cells? What's been known from the development, to your point, is that human disc can house around 3 million of cells. the studies, clinical current studies, are injecting, if I'm not mistaken, up to 30 million. So we are seeing this tenfold with the hope that some will survive, but whatever doesn't survive, it has that counter effect. And then the big other problem with that, with cells, just for us to keep in mind as we progress, because I think there are some great developments, is do they leak? And rabbits models that are often used for this regeneration, just because of the availability and cost, show some of the cadaver biomechanical studies that I believe 90% of injected material is lost within the first 30 minutes. So we have to keep in mind when we think, okay, this is the cell type we want to use, how quickly is going to leak the disc, especially if there are annular tears, and do we need a plug at the end of that syringe? So when we inject something, to plug, so to say, that annulus, or to your point, however we are injecting. And then there is one, I believe, clinical study using umbilical cord stem cells. That's a space that it's developing and testing. Maybe this is the better source. Chondrocytes, human chondrocytes have been used. But the problem with chondrocytes, why nasal chondrocytes, there are a few studies on nasal chondrocytes, we can't change them and redirect them to truly be nucleus pulposus. They still produce articular cartilage, and that's not the nucleus we want. So these are really the cells that have been so far used primarily in a clinical setting, which I think matters the most. And you mentioned that we always must keep in mind the comorbidities. Are we looking at a single level degeneration? And what is that? Furman grade 4 definitely is not a good candidate. And how much of a disc height loss are we looking at starting with the therapy? So that really leads to the question, Mark, what are we trying? You mentioned that at the beginning of our today's podcast. Are we trying to fix annulus, nucleus? There is end plate. So what if we even fix annulus and nucleus? If there are modic changes and end plate challenges, what if that pro-inflammatory is just seeping in from up and below? So what are your thoughts on that, like using all those different therapies and corralling them?
Well, that's a good point, you know, and I guess it comes back to what are we trying to achieve here? People go to the doctor because the back hurts. They don't go because of suppressed collagen type 2 or aggregate. So I think that leads to the next discussion about pain and can these therapies affect pain? One thing that I've not seen in preclinical studies in animals using cells, for example, is an assessment of pain. It's very difficult to do that. In mice and maybe rats, you can do facial recognition. You can't do that in dogs. I don't think you can do it in rabbits either. And so how do you measure if it hurts or not? So I think these are really important things to bear in mind, because we're looking at aggregate, collagen type 2, and cytokines, and disc height, okay, but a lot of people with disc height's okay, the back hurts. So, you know, that's something we looked at recently in this therapeutic injection. We looked at neurotrophins and neuropeptides in the annulus, where we injected the nucleus. We saw a stunning suppression of the expression of these pain-related proteins, but we still don't know if it hurt. It looks like it might have the capacity to suppress pain, but we don't know. So that's a real limitation, I think, some of the animal studies that are there. So that's, I think, one of the drawbacks or issues in doing this. I'm a little conscious of time here. So let me ask you, Zori, so taking it all in I guess, from a 30,000-foot view here, what do you think the future holds here? Is there any hope?
I think so. I think I wouldn't look at all the cells and protein therapies that we've done so far as a spine society as a failure. It's not sufficient. We are learning in the process. And as we said, this is very challenging. It's very different than just fusing a level or two. So I think these are great steps. And I'm excited to see where we are going to be in 5 years. And where the research is further and from a clinical perspective, really poking interest are homing mechanisms. So instead of really injecting X amount of million cells, there have been teams looking how can we attract stem cells or disc-like cells that are existing already around, and what are those signals of degeneration that will trigger them to use them as a homing and to get to the disc. So I'm very excited to see how that's gonna play out. And also, we didn't touch much about the scaffold, but obviously scaffold is super important, irrespective if you're looking at the cells, at the growth factors. So there have been there has been some work preclinical looking at decellularized matrix, which is, so to say, disc DBM. So potentially there is maybe something there that, that can be primed with cells or growth factors and give that biomechanical support as well. So I think a very interesting time ahead of us, but I don't know, what do you share the same view, or where do you see we can improve further?
No, I think you raise a good point. And again, I don't want to watch time here, but a lot of progress has been made. And I think people sometimes mistake failures for more than what they are, because I think you're right. We learn a lot. One of the drawbacks, as you know, is funding for these things. Like to be able to study like the dog study we did, and so that's expensive. And getting a lot of funding agencies, and particularly companies, don't want to fund you until you show human clinical data. Well, how do you show human clinical data until you've got the therapeutic? If you're talking about proteins, recombinant proteins in a GMP grade for humans is enormously expensive. You're not going to get that money from peer-reviewed funding sources. So that's one of the limitations, I think, here is how you fund this kind of work. But to your point, like there's a lot we need to know. If a protein injected works on viable cells, well, which ones? Are they viable nucleus pulposus cells? Are they viable NP cells plus maybe endogenous stem cells? Does any therapy rescue stem cell activation? Does that work? These are things that are important for us to know better in terms of how to dose appropriately and the choice of the if it's a protein will be used. And if it's the cells, like you said, between 3 and 30 million, that's a pretty wide a range, right? So if you need 30 million to do the job, that strikes me as you're just stuffing something in there until they secrete something good enough before they die off. So all these are very important limitations, but I still think we're making good progress down the road. And as we look at our past work and measure qualitatively, I think, and quantitatively our successes and what seems to work the best, maybe we'll be able to make some more measurable gains as we go forward. So I guess that's really all we have time for today. Any final thoughts from you, Zori, about this?
I think we'll have to do another podcast in a year or two. And
Maybe so. Okay, well, great. Well, then look, on that note, I guess I'll thank you very much for your help with all the previous podcasts and all of your contributions and everything else. It's been fantastic. It's been a pleasure doing it with you and for NASS. And we sure hope that the audience finds it of interest. And with that, we'll say goodbye for today. And thanks again, everybody, for watching.